the Madison Institute Forum presents a discussion of the national platforms of the two major political parties. The featured speaker is Charles Franklin, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His talk is followed by comments from two panelists. This event was sponsored by the Madison Institute and held in Madison, Wisconsin on September 13, 2008. Professor Charles Franklin.
I confess that this is the first set of platforms I've ever spent the time reading front to back. But they are awesome documents, and one of the things that's sort of interesting about them, I'll have a lot of bad things to say about them in a little bit, but if you go to there's a website that a former colleague of mine, John Woolley, at UC Santa Barbara runs, and on that page you can get every party platform, Democratic and Republican, since 1840. Now, on the one hand, you might say, what a colossal waste of time. This is what we pay academics for. But the other side of this is, for all of the things I'm going to criticize about these platforms in a few minutes, they are the time every 4 years that the parties have to sit down and try to sketch out what they're for. And in that sense, these platforms are not binding contracts with the American people. They're not even binding contracts with the presidential candidates who don't agree with everything that ends up in the platform. And yet, for all the sound and fury that goes into debating them and creating them, they are the party's document that says this is what we're for and this is what we're against. And so I wouldn't turn to, let's just say, the bottom of page 32 here, and say Republicans support measures to modernize the nation's electricity grid to provide American consumers and business with more affordable, reliable power. We will work to unleash innovation so entrepreneurs can develop technologies for the most advanced and robust United States transmission system that meets our growing energy demands. Okay? I'm not quite sure how that translates into legislation. Okay? I'm not sure how it shows up as regulation of anything. But it is the attempt of the parties to say what they stand for, sometimes in quite specific detail, far more often in the kind of broad terminology that I just read. Who could possibly be against a modern, efficient energy system? Okay? But nevertheless, to the extent that you see what the parties are saying and what their coalitions are demanding through these documents, I do think you see some things that are meaningful about parties and party differences and so on. So, frankly, I quit when I had gotten to, I think it's now 9 pages of single-spaced bullet points from these documents, and I didn't think you'd much appreciate me reading each one of those. At least I hope not. But I do want to stress where these things say issues, talk about issues that matter and present real differences between them. I don't think any of those differences will come as shocking surprises to you. But I also want to stress the areas, and this is my more critical mode, I want to stress the areas where both platforms seem to me to fall well short of what one might wish for the parties to address. But the reason they fall short is not fundamentally that they couldn't make up their minds. It's that fundamentally some of our problems are difficult enough that nobody wants to commit to a solution on paper. These have especially to do with taxes and entitlement programs and a few other little topics like that. So that's the overview of what I want to talk about here. Now let me get into a little bit more of the details. The first point is the difference in focus between the two parties. The Democratic platform starts by talking about the economy, domestic issues, economic stewardship, and so on. The Republican platform starts with supporting our heroes and securing the peace. Okay? And that difference in focus really reflects something that's not accidental. Republican strength has been, I mean, in terms of electoral strength, has been founded for the last many years since Ronald Reagan on a strong national defense, a commitment to U.S. Power and influence abroad. And the Democrats, whether they have opposed those things or merely have lost credibility as spokespeople for that, have tended to diminish those issues. You might imagine that in the current situation of the war in Iraq, that Democrats might have opened with international policy and a strong critique of Republican management of foreign affairs for the last 8 years. Yet they chose not to. Their preference was instead to talk with their strength in domestic affairs, their strength on the economy, on education, on the environment. Now, to be sure, the Democrats later come back to national defense and international policy, just as the Republicans later come to the economy and domestic affairs. But I think the ordering between these two is perhaps a little bit revealing about where this party's core focus is right now. When we look at those differences, two things strike me as standing out, and again, I don't think you'll be shocked by them. The first is that the Democratic platform is a very long list of things to address. Let me just read you a few of those, definitely not all. Affordable quality health care coverage for all Americans, not surprisingly, is the very first topic on their list. Retirement, good jobs with good pay, work and family, poverty, opportunities for women, a new American energy, world-class education for every child, science, technology, and innovation, creating new jobs and rebuilding infrastructure. And I'll quit there. But it's as you read through this, it looks like almost a caricature of Democrats by Republicans in the sense that it is a call for one government program after another to address these issues. You go page after page after page, with no suggestion of how private enterprise might be involved or how tax policy might be used to encourage private solutions, nor is there any hint of how these programs would be paid for. So in that sense, I think it's a Democratic document with all of Democratic flaws, as seen from other points of view, of solutions to the problem coming from the top rather than from other collective behavior, somewhat ironic given Barack Obama's emphasis on change coming from the bottom rather than from the top, and I would say opens up a classic critique of Democratic proposals, that these are things that if you are of the right moral view and the right view of problems that need addressing in the society, these are things that should be addressed, but to my point of view, shocking disregard for any concern about what these costs and what their implications might be for a federal budget that is now, thanks to 8 years of Republican rule, just to balance the ticket a little bit here, 8 years of Republican rule that took a large budget surplus and turned it into the largest budget deficit in American history. So whatever, if a Democrat, Barack Obama, makes it into the White House in January, he'll immediately be facing a gigantic deficit and a platform that seems to call only for more spending, more resources to be devoted to these programs. Of course, I could say the same thing on the Republican side. When we turn to their proposals a little bit later in the document on the economy, we see lots of strong support for tax cuts, further tax cuts, even though, in fact, the lower part of the income distribution is currently paying very little in federal income taxes because of previous tax cuts, and we see nothing to address the issue of growing inequality in the society, and particularly the extent to which tax cuts benefit the wealthy and encourage inequality in the society. And so if the Democrats have a solution to most of the problems listed here, and those solutions are, at least implicitly, federal action to address these problems, Republicans equally have a one-answer solution, and that's further tax cuts, sometimes coupled with further deregulation of markets. And so if I can be mean to both parties, I think both reflect in these documents the blinders that have, and the positions that have dominated American politics for, and I'll let you insert your own number of years, whether we want to start with the New Deal. But I would at least on the Republican side start with Ronald Reagan and the introduction of the idea of supply-side economics and that tax cuts can stimulate growth and higher taxes retard growth. That's an idea that was in sharp contrast to previous Republican ideals of small government and balanced budgets, and was essentially an argument that said we don't need to worry about the revenue side, we can just focus on reducing taxes. And yet that's an idea that has proven so intellectually powerful. I want to be careful here what I mean by that. Intellectually powerful in the sense that it dominates Republican Party thinking and dominates Democratic responses to those Republican proposals, and has done so now for 28 years. I don't think it was wrong, just to speak my mind here, that when Barack Obama said that Ronald Reagan had been the more important figure in American politics of the last 40 years compared to Bill Clinton. The Clintons were not terribly happy about that comment. But in terms of framing a view of government that had not been at the core of Republican principle and became the dominant policy proposal of the party for now 28 years, I think it's an amazing achievement, and it's an achievement of an idea, one that academic economists and others might roll their eyes at, justifiably so, but nevertheless, one of such political power that it has dominated policy debate for so long. And so if that theme runs throughout this Republican platform, it's a contrast and a parallel to the theme on the Democratic side that problems need to be addressed by federal action rather than through any other mechanism, to a dominant degree. So I think that's the sort of striking overview. If you were a space alien, you came down here and you read these two platforms, I think those are things that would really stand out to you right off the bat. I secondly wanted to talk about the things that the platforms, both of them, deal with in somewhat interesting ways, particularly the Democratic platform's support for increasing spending on the armed forces, for expanding the size of the military by a substantial amount, by strengthening U.S. forces. And apparently they read Don Rumsfeld's memo, because they also talk about force modernization and being prepared for 21st century conflicts, which ironically enough was exactly Don Rumsfeld's position in the Pentagon. Now, in part, what does this reflect? Well, it reflects changed circumstances, it reflects the fact that we're in a war, and it reflects the fact that constant troop rotations have forced this upon the party to recognize this as part of their critique of the Bush administration's policies. You have to conclude that the force is too small for this kind of job. So we see a lot of emphasis on that in the platform, but ironically, it's in the platform as a critique of Republican policy rather than the other way around. Read the Republican platform, they agree. They too would like to expand the military. They too would like to do force modernization. And so in this area, there seems to be a convergence between the parties in supporting military preparation. A nice quote from the Republican platform is that Republican leadership has given us the best military in the world, unlike the 1990s when national defense was neglected and underfunded by the Clinton administration. Every now and then these little phrases pop up in both platforms. You just can't resist, you know, you got to say something bad about the other side. But all of that comes together here in a world situation which has forced both parties to think about this. There's a second part to it, though, and this is maybe the less generous part. Either party, if pushed up against the wall, would have to consider just how expensive it would be to add another 40,000 permanent U.S. troops to the military roles. Neither wants to address that. Likewise, the enormous cost of replenishment of military supplies and materiel and Humvees, I guess they're called. But the cost and wear and tear on all of our equipment through the Iraq War has been phenomenally large. Both platforms are quite silent about that, except for these broad generalizations of modernization. Likewise, I could say that the Republican platform seems to take little notice of how its own stewardship of military affairs over these last 8 years of a presidency and 12 of the last 16 in the Congress have been. But neither party is in a position where they can publicly appear weak on defense. If 9/11 7 years ago did anything, it revised that. Again, the irony, this very quote that I used of the criticism of the Clinton administration weakening national defense. Doubly ironic because the budget path that the Clinton administration followed through the 90s was in fact the budget path that the first Bush administration had adopted following the fall of the Soviet Union. You don't need all of these divisions, you don't need all of these nuclear forces and so on. And so again, hypocrisy on both sides here, that the forces were drawn down under a Republican proposal, though administered by a Democratic administration, but to levels that were very much in line with what the first Bush administration had proposed. So oddly, I know you're shocked at this, neither platform particularly wants to do an honest evaluation of how we got the military we had. And indeed, whether in a rational calculus, the military we have now is or is not sufficient to the jobs we face. Okay? It's certainly not sufficient to the Iraq War right now, but that raises a question of how the war was run, how it was prosecuted, whether it should have been prosecuted in the first place. It also goes to the question of how we modernize defense. How do we think about the challenges of defense in the 21st century? Something that Democrats started to do in the late 70s, early 80s. Remember Gary Hart? Remember Sam Nunn and Scoop Jackson? Military Reform Caucus that was thinking seriously about how Democrats could reform defense policy in that period, that post-Vietnam period. And yet, partly because Hart lost the run for the presidency and ended up in some disgrace, that caucus, that Military Reform Caucus, kind of fell apart. And the Reagan administration, in its strong development of military affairs, took over and changed the discussion to one of heavy investment in strategic arms, in anti-Soviet kinds of buildups, whatever it was, 600-ship Navy, and so on. So the point I'm making here is both platforms address problems that were created through both parties' stewardship over this period. Now, faced with a situation where, for better or for worse, we've put ourselves in a position that is too demanding for our force structure, how do we refine that force structure to make it tenable? Now, well, one easy answer would be get out of Iraq right now, move half those divisions to Afghanistan, or for that matter, get out of Afghanistan too. That's Ron Paul's solution. And pull back from Japan and Germany and Korea as well. Those are possible solutions, but how do you do that? So both parties are good at talking a good game of build-up here. Neither is very good, I think, in these proposals in talking about how exactly to deal with it. Second thing, no one of either party wants to in any way be seen as critical of the troops. And so both parties go to great lengths to praise the members of our armed forces. The Republicans title it Supporting Our Heroes. And both go to great lengths to talk about increases in veterans' benefits, education benefits for returning veterans, health care for both. There are some small differences. I would say small. If you're a vet and affected by this, you might not see it quite the same way. But the small differences are things like whether the Republican platform calls for John McCain's plastic card, so if you're a vet, you can go to a healthcare provider locally rather than have to go to a potentially distant VA facility. The Democrats put a bit more stress on psychological care, like post-traumatic stress disorder. The Republicans managed to avoid using the phrase PTSD. They simply call it combat stress. Sounds like a slightly broken arm, the way they phrase it. But both are united in this, let's spend more, let's provide more services. Though I have to point out the Republican platform suggests that the solution to the VA education benefit, which is quite modest, is that private universities should just pay for the tuition gap with veterans. That's right there in the platform, what can I say? You know, you might argue that private universities do have way too much money. Certainly from a point of view of a state worker, I think that's true. But seriously, as serious policy analysis, it's a kind of silly way to think about providing for our veterans by one way or another, forcing private institutions to pay for it. But it is in keeping with the free market, I suppose, with government pressure, free market with government pressure. Okay, so these things they agree on. Those big points, pretty much the same. When we move to foreign policy, there's some differences, some significant differences of tenor. And I'm going to take Iraq off the table. I want to come back to Iraq and Afghanistan. The Democratic platform calls strongly for exactly what you would think Democrats these days would call for, more partnerships with other forces in the world, a deployment of NATO troops into Afghanistan, for example, but in general, working diplomacy and international power through cooperation with our partners in the world. Republicans say the same thing, as if the last 8 years had been one of great partnership as opposed to a coalition of the diminishingly willing and the vanishingly willing as well. And if that sounds partisan, I apologize, but I think it's essentially the contrast between Jim Baker and how he structured the coalition in the first Iraq War and the current Iraq War. And that difference is one more of the rhetoric we see here. The Republican platform has a variety of phrases and tenor that emphasizes American strength and power. The Democratic platform also emphasizes American power and strength, but much more through cooperation and multilateral action and so on. I wanted to speak specifically to the Iraq situation. Let me see if I can quickly quote you the Republican platform on this. It's on page one of the Republican platform. So again, it's sort of up front. The big heading is defending our nation, and the immediate subheading is the current conflict abroad. And if you read the next two paragraphs, you will not find the word Iraq appearing anywhere in that two paragraphs. But it goes on to say, this is now in the second, well, they're short, I'll read you both, because I want to not lapse into parody of these things. It's a cheap shot, and I love to take cheap shots whenever I can, but I am trying to be serious about what they're saying. All Americans should affirm that our first obligation is the security of our country. To all those who defend it, we owe our full support and gratitude. Okay? That's a classic preamble, right? High ideals. Again, either party could have written that paragraph of high ideals and nobility. And then the paragraph with the policy punch. The waging of war and the achieving of peace should never be micromanaged by a party platform or on the floor of the Senate and House of Representatives, for that matter. In dealing with present conflicts and future crises, our next president must preserve all options. I'm going to digress here to just point to the irony of a conservative party that likes a strong president, while the Democrats, the champion of the people, also likes a strong president. Sorry, folks. It would be, and back to the document, it would be presumptuous to specify them in advance and foolhardy to rule out any action deemed necessary for our security. And that's the end of the section on the current conflict abroad. Now, in fairness, later they have a section in the broader international policy that talks about Iraq and that talks about the goal of a peaceful, united, democratic Iraq that will be a friend of the United States and an important barrier to the expansion of Iranian power in the Middle East and so on. And, of course, in that same section do talk about opposition to withdrawal with any fixed deadline, but withdrawal only with conditions on the ground supporting that withdrawal. So, I don't want to parody what they're saying. They do have that, but it's not up in the front in the most prominent part of the international affairs part. In contrast, the Democratic platform calls for a pretty straightforward withdrawal from Iraq. So here's the Democratic platform on Iraq. To renew American leadership in the world, we must first bring the Iraq war to a responsible end. Notice that important word. Our men and women in uniform have performed admirably while sacrificing immeasurably. Our civilian leaders have failed them. Iraq was a diversion from the fight against the terrorists who struck us on 9/11. An incompetent prosecution of the war by civilian leaders compounded the strategic blunder of choosing to wage it in the first place. Here we go. I'm skipping a couple of things. We will be as careful getting out of Iraq as we were careless getting in. We can safely remove our combat brigades at the pace of one or two per month and expect to complete redeployment within 16 months. After this redeployment, we will keep a residual force in Iraq to perform specific missions, targeting terrorists, protecting our embassy and civil personnel, and advising and supporting Iraq security forces, provided the Iraqis are making political progress. Not quite clear what you do if they're not making political progress, but anyway. And so that's as straightforward a statement, I think, of a goal of withdrawal in 16 months. It's responsible, but it also says absolutely nothing about conditions on the ground. If suddenly there was a return, renewed bombings in the country, renewed civil strife and civil war, the platform is quite silent on what should be done in that situation. But the Democrats are not against war. They just want to move it to Iraq, to Afghanistan. And so if we skip a couple of pages, the goal is win in Afghanistan. Our troops are performing heroically in Afghanistan, but as countless military commanders and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff acknowledge, we lack the resources to finish the job because of our commitment to Iraq. We will finally make the fight against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban the top priority it should be. So if you buy the Democratic platform, you may very well be exchanging 130,000 troops in Iraq for 130,000 troops in Afghanistan. I'm sure that the troops and their families will understand the difference. Sorry, that was slightly editorial. But in all seriousness, thinking about how we do this deployment, and on the one hand, criticizing the Bush administration for the Iraq policy, but then substituting for that a new war policy or an expanded war policy in Afghanistan, may be the right strategic decision to make. To quote somebody famous, it's above my pay grade to decide what you're supposed to do on that. But the idea that a Democratic platform here is calling for an end of conflict or the end of troops fighting and dying is just not the case here. And so it's entirely plausible that if this platform is pursued, and for that matter, if Barack Obama's plans for escalation in Afghanistan are held, that Barack Obama could very well become the Democratic Richard Nixon, the president inheriting the war that was driven by his predecessor, and yet facing at least 4 years of being consumed by that war and by being just as embroiled in it as his predecessor was. So this is a platform that doesn't trace a clear theory to American withdrawal from combat, but it's rather one that accepts the notion that U.S. troops will be involved in combat, in fighting, quote, terrorism, but really fighting Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan. And maybe that's a perfectly good idea, but it's not a pacifist document. It is not a document or a policy proposal that says we should disengage from these kinds of activities, or for that matter, that we should shift them so that they're entirely done by special forces targeting specific individuals or small groups, as opposed to the deployment of major brigade and larger forces throughout the world. So those are the sort of highlights I would pick on international security, the military, and so on. And the two platforms, while somewhat different, are in other ways sort of constrained to be similar by the nature of the situation that we face. Well, if the Democrats started off with the economy and what we can do to renew America at home, those kinds of proposals are first and foremost headed by health care and quality, affordable health care or health coverage for all Americans. This has become the hallmark platform of every Democratic discourse for the, God, at least since 1992, I suppose, maybe sooner, earlier than that. It's an interesting thing about health care. When you ask Americans what's the most important problem facing the country today, well, right at the moment, the economy is the number one, and it usually is relatively high. The Iraq War was, of course, very high, though it's dropped off quite a bit. And then when you get past those top two or three issues, for the last 15 or 20 years, there's health care. But it's important to realize that health care is cited as most important by about 9% of the population. Okay? Not 40%. It is, I want to stress, the third, fourth, fifth most important, depending on whether gas prices have just spiked up or there's been some terrorist event or something like that, or the war is going badly. What's unique about health care is its persistence. I don't think it's dropped below 5%, rating it as the most important problem for the last 20 years, but it has only rarely climbed into the teens, 15% or so. When that happened was, first of all, during the Clinton administration's attempt at reforming health care, when it became a major policy issue and bumped up. It bumped up again when we were talking about Medicare Part D, the drug benefit, but it only bumps up for a little while, and then it comes back down in that steady high single digits as an important problem. And yet it's enormously popular among Democratic constituencies, and Democratic candidates constantly talk about it and use it in their campaigns as a cornerstone. Of course, that was a big part of the Clinton versus Obama debate this spring, was which health plan was more inclusive and so on. And yet it hasn't turned out to be a powerful electoral mechanism. Republicans have found ways to turn health care reform into a weapon against Democratic proposals. The most effective is just a very complicated organization chart of all the agencies involved, which is both very easy to parody and also betrays a profound lack of appreciation of just how complex health care is, that you really do need a really complicated chart to show all of the agencies and how they're connected. So anyway, so the Democratic proposals, again, push health coverage for all Americans, push it through some variety of mandates for coverage, appears to make those come through employer-provided plans, but is not entirely explicit about what that mechanism would be. And I think what we're seeing here is Democratic reluctance to openly embrace a national single-payer government-provided plan of the kind Canada, Great Britain, most of Europe have, okay? Because that's proven politically suicidal. You're going to take away my health care plan, okay? And every public school teacher's health care plan and most state employees' health care plans, that's not really a sellable proposition, and it does sound anti-free enterprise. So Democrats have been reluctant to go the full hog and go do that, but they've also been reluctant to embrace any of Republican proposals, which are in the Republican platform, that stress more about how to get individuals support, almost always through tax subsidies of some kind, to buy their own private insurance plans, thus being covered, but at the same time, through high deductibles or by passing costs directly to the person buying the insurance, creating more incentives to hold down health care costs. Okay? That's the Republican view of how you could both expand the pool of the insured, but at the same time get some kind of grip on costs. Well, here the plans are quite different, but both are trying to tread this middle ground. Republicans admitting there's a problem in trying to expand the coverage, but Democrats seeing this major problem but not being willing to go all the way out in a single-payer system, which some in the party, but a minority in the party, support. What both of these platforms, it seems to me, really fail on, and this is the first of two major failings I want to point to, three major failings, I guess, is how to pay for this and how to get the results that you want. The enormous costs of health care are partly driven by eligibility, but they're partly driven just because the hospitals cost so much, right? Every CAT scan, every new designer drug, every day in a high-tech intensive care unit is expensive. And the more we make that available, the more we drive up the cost. The Republican plan is recognizing that and saying, well, geez, if it came out of your pocket, if the first $5,000 was out of pocket, wouldn't that help you have an incentive to hold down the cost and thus lower the cost for everyone? And then the reply is yes, and there you are lying in the emergency room clutching your chest, and you say, wait a second, I don't think I want to pay for this test. It's not very realistic that way. But maybe it does keep you from going to the doctor asking for antibiotics when what you actually have is a cold. So, you know, there's an argument on both sides there. The Democratic plan suffers and is strongly opposed by not so much, interestingly, big corporations, but more so small business. There are lots of large corporations, General Motors being a prime example, that are very concerned that their high health care costs are hurting them in international competition and would actually like some kind of health care reform that shifted that burden off of their product line and onto someone else, like we'd all like someone else to pay our taxes. And so there's support there for some pretty major reform. But the problem is, much more through the very large number of small businesses in the country that have small profit margins, are struggling to survive. You know, most small businesses, the biggest business creation in the country is small business creation, creates more jobs than anything else, and has by far the highest failure rate as well, because it's a risky thing. I grew up in a struggling flower shop for 20 years. I know a little something about small business with three employees and the idea of the business trying to provide, you know, $1,000 a month health coverage for employees is really kind of tough. So my big point here is neither of these platforms really seriously address how do you pay for these things, whether it's through government subsidies or government mandates or subsidies of a different kind. If it's a tax rebate, it's still a subsidy paid by the government. This Republican notion that it's free enterprise is not quite right there, okay? But that's a huge issue. Likewise, both platforms talk in vacuous ways about holding down health care costs. And as far as I can see, neither offers any realistic appraisal of how that would actually happen. Now, a bit of reality. 2/3 of the federal budget is composed of entitlement spending and interest on the debt. Well, we've driven up the interest part of the debt by a fair march in the last 8 years or so. But we've also got what are those entitlements? Overwhelmingly, it's Social Security and it is Medicare and Medicaid. And there are a variety of other fairly big budget items, but those two together make up the biggest chunk of that. We all know about the long-term issues of how do you pay for Social Security with a diminishing working population and a growing elderly population. I want, since I see mostly white hairs around here, for us all to be very grateful that young people don't vote, because that means our Social Security will be protected because we do vote, okay? And if they all start voting, we could be in serious trouble, so be careful what you wish for. But joking aside, so we have this huge problem of how to fund this in the long run. The platforms speak to this, but only in the most vague and general terms of assuring the long term. A Republican platform, boy, you got to give them some credit, even though it was wildly unpopular in 2005 when President Bush proposed it. The Republican platform still calls for private savings accounts for Social Security, okay? While stressing that that doesn't mean that anybody would lose benefits to which they're currently entitled. The Democratic platform's exactly the opposite. No privatization of Social Security at all. And those are absolutely strong policy platforms for both parties, and neither one of them says a thing about how to deal with the actual fiscal implications of it. And so again, But I don't know why. I certainly have no plan to solve it, so I don't know why we should hold them to one. The last thing I wanted to talk about was tax policy, an area where the platforms do differ significantly and, again, partially close their eyes to some of the obvious implications of their proposals. The Republican platform continues to call, as it has since the Reagan innovations in the 80s, for maintaining the Bush tax cuts, for indeed increasing tax cuts, and for the broad economic belief that lower taxes are stimuluses to growth and therefore are good for the country on those grounds. The Democratic platform also calls for tax cuts. You will recall what I said a minute ago, that Ronald Reagan really did have a gigantic intellectual impact on the nation, in that Democrats agree that low taxes are good, except for that top 5% making more than $250,000, and we can get all of our taxes from those guys while cutting everybody else's taxes. Now, again, that may be a perfectly good policy, and it's not my job here to defend one policy or the other, but the goal of that is, again, to shift the burden of taxes. We need more revenue, but modern American society post-Reagan has made it impossible for anyone of either party to stand up and say, I want to increase your taxes. You remember the last Democratic politician to try that, Walter Mondale, won one state plus the District of Columbia, right? He said, the difference is we're both going to raise your taxes. I'll tell you, he won't. Well, he lost. Okay, and so neither party is very willing to address this. Republicans would rather abandon their historic commitment to balanced budgets if it means any violation of their tax pledges. And so we've, you know, granted the war has played a big role in this, and a fair-minded person might set aside the costs of the war as an external event, setting aside the issues of judgment, but set that aside. We've still grossly expanded our deficit, and the major tax cuts that went in the early Bush administration were part of that, but they were exactly the core of Republican platforms in 2000, 2004, and now, and they refuse to believe that deficits are driven by tax cuts or important for tax cuts. Instead, the platform talks about eliminating, wait for it, waste, fraud, and abuse. If only I had 0.1% of waste, fraud, and abuse, I would be a wealthy, wealthy person. On the one page of the Republican platform, they remind us that 2/3 of spending is not discretionary spending. Out of a $3 trillion budget, $2 trillion are Social Security, health care, and other, the national debt, and a few other entitlement programs. Only 1/3 is everything else that government does. And yet, waste, fraud, and abuse is somehow supposed to solve our problems. So the Republican platform is big on the idea that we could have a sunset law on government agencies. Give them 5 years, and if they haven't cured the problems of poverty, hunger, or whatever, we'll shut them down. I'm sorry, I said that. They didn't say that. To be serious and give them credit. What they say is, agencies get created and then they last forever. What sense does that make? Why are there 77 different programs in 19 different agencies all concerned with nutrition for kids under 5? Doesn't that seem a little excessive? Well, that's the Republican platform's point of view. Okay, and so they have some proposals, but the proposals are so disproportionate to the amount of money we're talking about. And history has shown that when it comes to Republicans voting to shut down programs, Republicans are just as reluctant to vote to shut those down as Democrats are in most cases, not all cases. Shutting down public broadcasting, that's an exception. The Democrats, on the other hand, seem absolutely immune to the notion that government has to raise revenue to pay for all of these programs, and where would that come from? And, you know, the old joke, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that fellow behind the tree, really does permeate their document. It seems that those in that top few percentages of the income distribution can absorb all of our expenses and so on. Okay, I've left out practically 90% of the platforms, but I've tried to focus on what I think are the big issues and where both parties address things, sometimes in similar ways because the nature of politics today pushes them to it, and sometimes in ways that are absolutely typical of the different views of the two parties. And both of them, it seems to me, are remarkably blind to any of the really difficult problems and any potential solutions to those. Okay, thank you.
Now we hear the comments of two panelists. The first is Bill Krause, who has been active in Republican Party politics for over 50 years. He is highly respected by members of both parties and is now on the board of Common Cause in Wisconsin. Bill Krause.
I've been kicking around in politics for 56 years, and this is the first time I ever read a platform. I want to talk to what it tells us about our political parties and the behavior of our incumbents. And I'll talk mostly about the Republicans because I'm not familiar with the inner workings of the Democratic Party. The Republican Party platform is largely food for the red meat partisans. Okay, I agree with this. Individualism is great. This is great. Taxes, low taxes are great. With a few sops thrown in for the lobbyists who represent the money so that they can go back to the money and say, see, I got this in the platform and now give me more money. So it's a lot of hype and a lot of reassurance. The thing that continues to bewilder me about the way the Republican Party and the Republican candidates operate is they keep playing to the yellow dogs who are going to vote for them anyway, and then worse yet, they play to the mad dogs who are impossible, who are going to make demands on them that they can't possibly fulfill. There is the difference I noticed between the two platforms was that the Democrats are somewhat more show somewhat more flexibility. The Republicans are much less accommodating to other points of view, and the it came clear to me in the talk about guns. Nobody is going to take on the NRA, but the Democrats did concede that maybe this is not an ideological issue, maybe this is a geographical issue, and that what is permissible and expected in Stevens Point and Rhinelander may not work very well in the city of Milwaukee, and you may have to have some accommodation to the geographical differences. Republicans do not relent on that. As Charles said, the health care issue is largely an inside the beltway issue. And everybody has very strong opinions on it. The Republican Party that I came out of, it was known for its competence. We weren't ever warm and fuzzy, but we did, the Democrats had the ideas and then we made the ideas work. We've lost track of that somewhat. But there's an opportunity in healthcare to just deal with it realistically. We have got socialized medicine in this country. Nobody is dying on the steps of the hospital. What we've got is an enormously inefficient system. And the Republicans are the guardians of efficiency. They're the we do things better. So we have that opportunity to talk about healthcare as not a policy problem, not an ideological problem, but an efficiency problem. It doesn't work very well. We can make it work better. And we passed that opportunity, to my astonishment. If these two platforms were enacted and handed to, as statutory items, and handed to the candidates, the country would come to a complete stop. Because right now we have a serious case of hardening of the arteries, and this would complete it, because there's no accommodation built into this system. The other thing that surprises me is if these were important political documents, they would appeal to the middle, not the people who are sure of their positions. It's the people who are like you and me, who are confused and looking for solutions to problems that are probably unsolvable. So it's a different world. It's a difficult world. It's an event-driven world. The candidate you should vote for is the person who you think will deal with whatever happens in the next 4 years that nobody expects to happen.
The second panelist is Professor Joseph Elder, Department of Sociology, University of Wisconsin, Madison. Professor Joseph Elder.
Probably this is not terribly relevant for what's going to happen between now and November. Nonetheless, it's interesting to read, and as both Charles and Bill have said, there's a philosophy that sort of percolates through these, which isn't terribly surprising. We could sort of not read them and say what they're going to say. But the fact that they are said gives one a little sense of a continuity here. There is a Republican Party, which in principle has been for small government, careful spending, and conservatism. And then there's been the Democratic Party, which has been looking for progressive ideas, concerns for the way in which the collective can work for the good of the people, and expand the sort of services that the government provides for its citizens. And those two broad strategies come percolating through. I loved the jabs. Every time you could say things have been bad, it's because of Bush, or it's because of the Democrats. And whatever it was, and it could be the same thing, the declining economy is because of, and then fill the blank, because it depends which side is putting the material together. But I have pulled out a couple of things which are kind of, I think, sleepers. Things that are there, which you might pass over, and then when you stop and think, what's really being said, it may be a little bit more sinister than one might think. Well, let me go to, and actually Charles read this, and I'm just going to read it again, but perhaps emphasizing a little portion. It has to do with the role of the president. Now, one thing that I have been concerned about, as have others, have been the expansion of executive power. The fact that increasingly we've seen the president simply sort of bypass Congress, decide what is or isn't torture, decide who is or is not going to be have their telephones and their emails checked. And here it says, the waging of war and the achieving of peace, so that's everything, should never be micromanaged in a party platform or on the floor of the Senate and House of Representatives for that matter. Okay, it is the president. In dealing with present conflicts and future crises, that's about everything, our next president must preserve all options. It would be presumptuous to specify them in advance and foolhardy to root out any action deemed necessary for our security. That is a walk toward dictatorship. When you actually look at what's said there, it says Congress, back away. The president must manage war and peace, and it would be foolish and dangerous to allow the Senate and the House of Representatives to become involved. Now, I think it's tucked in so early in the statement that maybe it's missed, but you read it and think, what is the real implication there? The real implication is essentially we are now telling the president that he should do what he feels is important, and there's not much of a role for the Senate and the House of Representatives. So that was one that sort of caught my eye. Another thing that caught my eye had to do with military policy, and I agree with Charles that when push comes to shove, it's kind of hard to separate the policy. But here's a statement about missile defense, which some of us who've been particularly suspicious about have been concerned. This has not worked. It's been incredibly expensive. It has won us enemies in various parts of the world, and it's a huge drain on the exchequer. What does the Republican platform say about missile defense? We must develop and deploy both national and theater missile defenses to protect the American homeland, our people, our armed forces abroad, and allies. Effective, layered missile defenses are critical to guard against the unpredictable actions of rogue regimes and outlaw states, reduce the possibility of strategic blackmail, and avoid the disastrous consequences of an accidental or unauthorized launch by a foreign power. Now we look at, let's go back to 9/11. What would a successful missile defense system have had to do with that? Well, first of all, it doesn't work. We haven't yet gotten anything that can knock much out of the sky, and we spent billions of dollars. But the other is, that's not where most of the threat comes to American security. There are many, many other sources for it. And even the 9/11 Commission has looked at a series of much sort of lower tech things that need to be done in terms of the security of harbors, the security of chemical plants, and so on. So this is sort of going back to the Cold War strategy. The missiles are going to come from, get this, rogue nations and outlaw states. And somehow we have to have our missile defenses all over the place, including Poland or Czechoslovakia or, I don't know, Georgia, whatever the next place might be, that somehow will protect us. And as we look at what that has cost us financially and what it has cost us in terms of the strain it puts upon relations right now, Russian-U.S. relations are particularly strained, and a not important factor has been our urge to put a missile defense system that I would contend is unnecessary and untested, but in the middle of a situation which is quite tense and quite complicated. In terms of health, I think the program is going to be, and we already heard it, that the term socialized medicine will be used again and again by Republicans at anything that suggests other than the free market system. And let me read the statement here. The American people rejected Democrats' attempted government takeovers of health care in 1993, and they remain skeptical of politicians who would send us down that road. Love the imagery. Republicans support the private practice of medicine and oppose socialized medicine in the form of a government-run universal health care system. Having said that, that's not going to be allowed, then it says Republicans pledge that as we reform our health care system, and then it goes on to say it will protect citizens. So we're once again back into the same, the Republicans are saying we aren't going to go that way, and we're going to use the stigma of socialized medicine because that sort of jars Americans' nerves. And then when it goes to what is going to be done, as Charles said, it's extraordinarily vague. This doesn't mean the Democrats are any clearer, but at least the thrust of the Democratic platform is that we have a serious problem of nearly half a hundred million people without health care. And we can't just say, let's keep things going as they are. It would be difficult and it will be expensive, but it must be thought about. It can't be simply waved away as let the private practice of medicine take care of it. And the last little point I want to raise, but I think it's going to become one that will surface again and again, because one sees it in the bushes, and it will come out into the open. And that has to do with Roe versus Wade. It's fairly clear what the position of the platform is. And I think in this case also it's the position of the candidates. And perhaps it's become even sort of clearer with the selection of the Republican vice presidential candidate. This is something that is important, and she speaks eloquently for it. It's titled, it's page 52, Maintaining the Sanctity and Dignity of Human Life. Faithful to the first guarantee of the Declaration of Independence, we assert the inherent dignity and sanctity of all human life and affirm that the unborn child has a fundamental individual right to life which cannot be infringed. We support a human life amendment to the Constitution, and we endorse legislation to make clear that the 14th Amendment's protections apply to unborn children. We oppose using public revenues to promote or perform abortion and will not fund organizations which advocate it. We support the appointment of judges who respect traditional family values and the sanctity and dignity of innocent human life. And that's, I'd say, almost in bold print in terms of that policy. Well, those are simply a few kind of responses to the fine print in here. I'm glad I read it. I'm wiser for it. I took Latin once upon a time, and I told it would be better for taking Latin, and I had the same sort of feeling. It's an exercise from which one benefits in a variety of different ways.
Audio recordings of many other thought-provoking programs are available at our website. Go to www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.